be seated. Colleen, Green Bay Professional Police Association, City of Green Bay, 21AP102. Could I please have your appearances?
Good morning, Rob. Mr. Miller, on behalf of the Green Bay Professional Police
Association. All right, good morning. I have 25 minutes followed by 30 and 5 minutes on rebuttal. Okay? All right, let's proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Cermelli. I represent the Green Bay Professional Police Association and Andrew Pace. Although there are a number of issues that this court accepted the petition for review on, I think they can be boiled down to two. First is whether the government acting as an employer can deprive a police officer of his property right and wages without providing notice and an opportunity to be heard on the charges which form the basis for the discipline simply because the government told him during an investigation that he would be questioned on, among other things, the policy violations eventually imposed. The second is whether the arbitrator manifestly disregards the law or whether an arbitrator manifestly disregards the law by merely citing to the governing law at issue but then applying completely irrelevant precedent. For almost 40 years, the law has required that a police officer's property interest in his or her wages be provided with two simple things, notice and an opportunity to be heard. This case is a notice case. It is only a hearing case to the extent that notice was not provided and impacted Mr. Weiss's ability to be heard at a Loudermill hearing. The purpose of those factors are simple. Provide an initial check as to mistaken decisions. That's what our Loudermill case says. And to determine whether there are reasonable grounds to believe that the charges, important word, charges against the employee were true and support the proposed evidence, or the proposed action, excuse me. Unfortunately, I believe the Court of Appeals decision below has upended that time-honored test. It's now lawful for the government, again, acting as an employer, to deprive a police officer of his property right and continued wages without advising him or her of the specific disciplinary charges being considered, as long as two things happened. One, the officer had been questioned at some time during the investigation about, two, a policy violation on which discipline is eventually imposed.
Counsel, I have a foundational question for you. The parties, although an amicus did, the parties the Eldridge, it seems that both sides seem to assume that Loudermill applies to this case and governs it, but I think it was actually Matthews that developed the three factors we're supposed to apply in order to determine what process is due. Could you address that, please?
Absolutely. I did not address Matthews because it seemed to me self-evident that when you look at the Matthews versus Eldridge factors, notice, as opposed to an opportunity to be heard, is not something that can be truncated. You look at the three, there are three factors in Matthews. One, so my point is this is a Matthews case, clearly, and you have to look at the Matthews factors to decide whether notice was appropriate. What are those factors? Number one, the private interest affected. I think that would be significant in this case. It's $80 a month, $1,000 each over the course of a career. Number two, what's the risk of the erroneous deprivation? There is, again, with regard to notice and notice only, there is a direct relationship between the lack of notice and an erroneous deprivation. How do we know? Because there's another little sub-factor in Matthews that talks about the likely value of additional procedures. What is the likely value of additional procedures here? All we're talking about, again, is notice. So would there be any value in providing Officer Weiss, then Detective Weiss, a full complement of all the charges upon which discipline would be given or imposed? The answer to that is is no, there is no problem with it, and it would likely be of great value, obviously, because the officer can't know what he is supposed to respond to unless and until he's given notice of what is at issue. And finally, the government's interest. This is most often the factor on which courts side with regard to truncating a hearing, modifying the hearing in some fashion, whether it's Homar, whether it's a variety of cases. What is the government's interest here? I think the key thing is that you have to question whether the City of Green Bay Police Department had a, quote, legitimate interest, unquote, in not providing Officer White with a list of all the charges that upon which he would be disciplined. If the Green Bay PD had that, then they can get away without giving full notice. If they didn't have a legitimate interest, they cannot. This is not a case like the Homar case in the U.S. Supreme Court, where the government had to act quickly. This is not a case where the subject of the property deprivation was already in custody and charged, such that a hearing and notice might really not be important anymore. Moreover, the Green Bay PD acknowledged application of Loudermill. How do we know that? Because they complied with it. They gave a Loudermill notice in writing saying, here's what I'm planning on issuing discipline for. Come on in and tell me if you have any concerns or tell me what you might want to let me know. They provided that notice. For the government or Green Bay PD right now to say that, well, you know, it really doesn't matter, those three charges that we didn't tell them about, it's belied on by the fact that they provided notice with regard to five other ones. So Matthews does apply, Your Honor, and it was my error if I didn't point that out clearly in the briefs.
Can you address the fact that the posture here is that we're reviewing decision of the arbitrator, which I think puts it in a very different context than it would be were we just reviewing it outside of
sure.
the realm of an arbitrator's decision?
Sure. I think this would be a much simpler case if it was not involving an arbitral decision. But it is. And so the question is, you know, must the decision be final and binding on the merits, or is there a reason to vacate the decision? And I believe there clearly is a reason to vacate the decision with respect to the arbitrator. I think he got it wrong. Why? Because, like the Court of Appeals, he focused on the process, quote unquote, and the hearing, quote unquote, as opposed to the lack of notice in the first place.
But in order for you to win, don't you need to prove that the arbitrator either had a perverse misconstruction or engaged, I think it's a he, in conduct, manifestly disregarded the law, the award was illegal, or the award violates strong public policy?
I do. I'm not accusing the arbitrator of doing anything ethically inappropriate. However, I believe the arbitrator clearly manifestly disregarded the law in this case, and that is a basis for vacatur. Why? Well, there are two cases that I think are important. One is the Orlowski case, Orlowski versus State Farm Mutual, and the second is Racine County versus International Association of Machinists. Those two cases teach us three things. One, that an arbitrator is required to apply the governing law correctly. Number two, the arbitrator is required to apply the relevant law. And number three, an arbitrator manifestly disregards the law by failing to do either number one or number two.
You think that we should overturn or vacate an arbitration award if they fail to get it right?
No.
On the law, they fail to apply the governing law correctly?
No, I'm not saying you should overturn the arbitral decision to get it right. What I'm saying is you should follow precedent of this court in Orlowski and Racine County to determine whether or not the arbitrator's failure to address notice resulted in manifestly disregarding the law. Now, the arbitrator's entire summation, the entire application or analysis of the constitutional issue in this case is one paragraph long. Did not address notice. He didn't. He mentioned Loudermill, but then he quickly went on to another Supreme Court case that deals with a complete irrelevancy to our case. That is whether or not there was a neutral pre-termination adjudicator. What did the arbitrator say? And this is at my appendix on 34 to 35. The relevance Weiss puts on Loudermill is misplaced. In Loudermill, the court balanced competing interests specific to the discharge of a public employee. The weight accorded to Loudermill varied depending on the severity of the disciplinary action. Subsequent cases have confirmed that a neutral pre-termination adjudicator is not required where there is also a post-termination administrative procedure. In the present case, the arbitrator serves as the post-disciplinary administrative procedure and satisfies the due process requirements under Loudermill, particularly given the disciplinary action taken was short of discharge. So what did the good arbitrator do? He cited to the law that the parties had argued and referenced, but he didn't apply it. How do we know he didn't apply it? And applying the relevant law and the governing law is absolutely required. Because he didn't analyze what the law said. He didn't analyze what the law required vis-a-vis the facts in this case. Was there a lack of notice given? Did the government have a legitimate interest in choosing not to give complete notice? What was the impact of that? That's the basis for vacater.
And you get that from, because I'm looking at the holding of Loudermill. I just don't think this is as clear as you are presenting to us in terms of what the federal law actually requires. It's pretty vague. Loudermill, it's a due process, and we recognize in all the cases, ours and the Supreme Court, that due process is a movable, it's not always definable like this, this, and this. It changes, it morphs depending on what the situation is. But here, Loudermill says that what you need is a pre-termination opportunity to respond coupled with post-termination administrative procedures. So what exactly did you want the arbitrator to do, given that this is not, there is no law that sets forth that you must notify them of each and every statute pre-termination? I mean, this is Loudermill. This is what the framework is. So what would you have this arbitrator do that you think is manifestly wrong?
First of all, Loudermill at its core was a hearing case, not a notice case. Matthews, which predated Loudermill, says what needs to be analyzed, three factors, vis-a-vis both notice and an opportunity to be heard. So in Loudermill, the key issue was that Mr. Loudermill wasn't given an opportunity to be heard. There was no issue as to notice. Same case in the Schacht decision in the Seventh Circuit. That wasn't an issue as to whether or not Mr. Schacht was given notice. The question was, was he given a proper hearing? So if you look at the three factors in Matthews versus Eldridge, and apply them to the notice, I believe that is clearly problematic. There's no question Loudermill required giving of notice. Absolutely none. That's one of the two things that has to happen. And we know what the tests are for notice. Matthews versus Eldridge, three factors. Now, how did we get here? As I said, it's a notice case, not a hearing case. And sometimes that distinction gets lost in the case law. And it's easy simply to forget what's at issue and bundle it together. And unfortunately, I think that's what the arbitrator did, and I believe that's what the Court of Appeals did. The Court of Appeals wrongly focused on the process associated with Weiss's Loudermill hearing, not the lack of notice. What did the Court of Appeals say? This is at decision at, page 11 of the decision. In sum, the process afforded to Weiss is exactly the type of process envisioned by the court in Schacht as meeting the pre-disciplinary due process requirements, at least where extensive post-disciplinary opportunities for review are available. Accordingly, Weiss's procedural due process rights were not violated, even though the Loudermill notice failed to allege violations of policies 701 and 1008. So the Court of Appeals, it recognizes the problem with notice, but it doesn't take the ball and run with it and mixes it up with the process, the procedure.
But counsel, isn't notice part of the process? Because you are advancing a due process claim in this case, right? So notice is a part of that. It's not all of it because, of course, an opportunity to be heard must also be provided. So, yes, it is a notice case, but are you arguing a distinction between notice and due process?
No, I'm sorry. I'm arguing a distinction between notice and the opportunity to be heard. Those are two separate factors. They are all part of the same process. What apparently I am inartfully explaining is that it's very easy to lump these two very important separate entities, instances, issues together and miss the forest for the trees.
So just to zero in on your argument, centers on the failure to receive notice in the final complaint regarding policies 701.2 and 0.5 and policy 1008. Is that correct?
Let me address that because here's a, you know, I sat through the last hearing and I was thinking, my goodness, that case was confusing to me. And this case, this case can tend to be confusing too, although it shouldn't be. The complaints that you're referencing, Justice Bradley, are Chapter 164 notice. We have the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights in Wisconsin, and it simply says, if my memory serves, a law enforcement officer who is subject to interrogation for any reason which may lead to discipline, demotion, or discharge shall be entitled to two things. One, the representative of his or her choice, and two, notice of the scope of the interrogation. Now, that's what these complaints are.
I think it says nature of the investigation.
The nature of the investigation, yes, I'm sorry, instead of scope, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And so when I read the summary that the court put out earlier, I was troubled because, you know, that's not the notice we're talking about. That's the notice that the Court of Appeals relied on incorrectly. All right, there are two types of notices. The notice a cop gets before he's interrogated. That's Chapter 164 that we just talked about. The second type of notice is the notice that any governmental employee with a property interest, including cops, get before they're questioned, before they are disciplined. All right, two different types of notices. I think we're somewhat unique in Wisconsin because we have a Chapter 164 notice. That Chapter 164 notice, law enforcement rights, formed the basis for what you referred to, Justice Bradley, as the first and the second complaint. Green Bay's PD simply says, here's a complaint, formal complaint against personnel. It's notice. That's what it is.
But, okay, what I'm getting at is you're not making a claim under Section 164, right? You're making a constitutional claim, due process claim, right?
Correct.
Okay. So when I'm looking at that, and even if Loudermill applies, and I'm not sure that it does here, but that for the moment, even if it applies, Loudermill says oral notice is okay. So when I'm looking at the facts of this case, he was handed the policies at, I think, the first November interview, and then there was a second, I think, November interview. So he was handed those policies. Why isn't that sufficient notice for constitutional purposes, regardless of the label we put on it as a 164 and not a 164?
Because the label and the timing is important. Those are notices that are given prior to an officer being interrogated, all right? Then the interrogation is completed, the investigation is completed, and the chief says, hey, I'm planning on issuing discipline. That's a new phase, all right? That's the Loudermill notice. The chief can do it orally, or he can do it in writing. This chief did it in writing and identified five rules that he believed Weiss had violated. That's the Loudermill notice, okay? They then had a hearing. Weiss was able to be heard on those five, and discipline was eventually issued on three different ones. Now, I take issue with the assertion, and I think I heard it implied in your question, that during the Loudermill hearing itself, Weiss may have been given notice as to the three new rules. He was not.
Which date are you calling the Loudermill hearing?
The Loudermill hearing occurred on 12/21 of 17. Same date as the Loudermill notice, the letter.
Okay. But what I'm saying is it appears he was given copies of those policies at the November interview. So my question was, why wasn't that notice sufficient, even if it wasn't formalized, listed?
Sure. I think I understand the question. All right. Imagine this. You're subject to interrogation, and your boss tells you, look, we're going to look at the following 48 rules. That's the scope of the investigation or the nature of the investigation. And then the investigation is concluded, and your boss's boss, the chief, says, I'm planning on issuing discipline for these five rules. Do you have anything you want to tell me? What is the officer going to do? The officer is going to say, okay, they might have questioned me about 48 rules, but the chief is telling me he's going to implement discipline on five. So when you get to the Loudermill hearing, that's all a reasonable officer will address, is the five. He or she is not going to say, well, besides those five, chief, there were 47 other ones or 43 other ones that you didn't identify, but I think it's important for me to answer those. It's just not reasonable. The officer who's going to be deprived of property is thinking, what do I have to respond to? I have a finite amount of time. Let me respond to what my boss's boss is telling me is a concern. So the notice that may have been given about 100,000 other potential rule violations early on in the investigation is really irrelevant as to whether or not the Loudermill notice is appropriate and whether the officer is then provided the ability to respond thereto.
As a factual matter, in this case, does it matter? Because as I understand it, and I think this is the argument that Green Bay is making, he was disciplined for leaking confidential information to a reporter, and so these other policy violations related to personal communication devices and cooperation are somewhat ancillary. Could you respond to that argument?
That's not at all correct. If you look at the facts in the case, what the chief did, and the chief's testimony is in my brief, and if you look at page 41 of my brief, the chief admits that he did not advise Weiss of the three rule violations that I'm talking about during the Loudermill. Okay?
Know about them? Because wasn't he refusing to turn over his phone during the earlier interview? And the chief said, look, you need to, like, you're going to be in trouble if you don't turn over your phone. Wasn't that the basis behind the personal communication device and the failure to cooperate? It wasn't like this came out of nowhere.
Sure. If you look at look at the transcript of the Loudermill hearing, that's in the record. And I'll point it out to you specifically when I get back for rebuttal. But the transcript of the Loudermill hearing, the chief is very clear. He addresses the five factors that are in the Loudermill notice, and then he says, look, there's this other big thing I'm worried about.
Right. I read it actually yesterday.
But what is he referring to? He, the chief. The chief is referring to a different incident, a different investigation, one that did not involve Weiss leaking information to an alderman, not a reporter, one that involved something completely different, for which Weiss was never disciplined and never charged.
But he's still talking about him turning over his phone, and he's saying, you're not going to turn over your phone? You're not going to give us all the information?
Well, let's say that is correct, and I don't think the record supports that. I don't think the facts support it, but let's say that is correct. Does it really matter? If he wasn't given, he meaning Weiss, if he wasn't given notice in the Loudermill notice that the use of his phone or failure to cooperate with an investigation was at issue, those things shouldn't be addressed. And to the extent that they are addressed, that's problematic. That's why, again, I say this is a notice case more than it is a hearing case.
Right. And I hear what you're saying. I'm going to understand what you're saying. I'm just not sure it squares with even the language in Loudermill itself when it talks about due process and talks about due process just requires notice, opportunity to respond. I feel like he had notice here and opportunity to respond. And then it goes on to talk about a public employee is intended to oral or written notice of the charges against him, an explanation of the employer's evidence, opportunity to present his side of the story. To require more than this prior determination would intrude an unwarranted extent on the government's interest in quickly removing an unsatisfactory employee. So I feel like you're like, the way you're looking at it is just, it's so heavily balanced on one side and not the other. Can he respond, Chief Justice? I know his red lights.
May I? Thank you. Let's forget about Loudermill for a minute because you're troubled by it. Look at two other cases. Memphis Light and Gas versus Kraft. 436 U.S. 1, 1978. Again, a notice case. What did it say? Notice must permit adequate preparation for an impending hearing. That's at page 14 of the decision. It also says that the purpose of notice is to inform of the process and to allow the employee to present objections. Again, at page 14. The other case is Morrissey versus Brewer, 408 U.S. 471, 1972. Again, a notice case. What does it say? It says, the notice should state what, in this case it was a parole violation, what parole violations have been alleged, unquote. 408 U.S. at 487. So to the extent that Loudermill muddied the interplay between notice and an opportunity to be heard, forget it. Move on and look at Memphis Light and Gas. Look at Morrissey versus Brewer. Look at the Matthews versus Eldridge case. Thank you.
I think Loudermill was decided after those two, but thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is William Fisher. I'm appearing on behalf of the City of Green Bay. I'm thankfully going to skip over the first two pages of my outline and go straight to Justice Bradley's point regarding Matthews versus Eldridge. I too agree that perhaps the parties paid short shrift to Matthews in their briefing, and I do think it's appropriate to correct that.
Does Loudermill apply, though, in a demotion case? This didn't involve a firing. I know the U.S. Supreme Court has not been crystal clear on it, but I think this court has. So it seems like everybody's assuming Loudermill applies. Do you make that assumption based on the cases or something else?
Well, I think that's an excellent question I will fall on my sword once again. The amicus Wisconsin Chiefs of Police points to this court's Arneson decision. Arneson is a case that didn't deal whether or not notice was provided. Instead, it dealt with a survey of the law as to what the law was regarding notice that need be provided prior to discipline that fell short of termination. In that case, this court talked about Loudermill and did, in fact, pose the same question that you posed, Justice Bradley. Does Loudermill even apply where there is no termination? That is an open question. I think that one of the things that this court has the opportunity to do today and in this is to continue the conversation it began in Arneson.
I was going to say you might want to move that podium up.
I'm working on it here. Thank you. Continue that conversation that began in Arneson. Arneson certainly um, It goes through several prior decisions, including Loudermill, including the Gilbert versus Homar decision from the United States Supreme Court, as well as various Seventh Circuit cases. The Arneson Court, this court, stated, quote, Seventh Circuit cases serve as evidence that the due process requirements attendant upon deprivations of property interests less significant than continued employment may be less than that required of Loudermill for terminated employees. Arneson is this court's most recent extensive discussion of Loudermill and therefore deserves due consideration. Arneson can be read as questioning whether notice and opportunity to be heard under Loudermill prior to discipline is even necessary where the discipline falls short of termination.
Yeah, but you don't know what the discipline's going to be till the act is done. And that's what you need the notice for is before you get that far down the road, right? So how do you work that into... I understand what you're saying. I haven't read Arneson, but I certainly will. But I don't see how that quite applies because they're saying, well, if it's less than termination, well, you don't know what's going to be the discipline till it's all done. That's at the end of the road.
Sure, I understand that, Justice Rogan-Sack, but the point of due process analysis is such that it's part and parcel of it is that it's looking through hindsight. And it's the court deciding whether, in light of the facts and circumstances of each particular case, which is required by flexible due process concerns, whether in light of those facts, due process attendant to those facts was given.
So it's always retrospective, is what you're saying.
That's the nature of court review, right? It's always retrospective.
But
looking back,
retrospective doesn't help you at the beginning of the process, though, when you're trying to comply with what the law requires.
And I do take your point, Justice Rogan-Sack, and perhaps this court's decision in this case will provide further clarification, and which is an excellent reason to be here talking to all of you fine justices on a Monday morning.
Even if Loudermill does apply, could you address the officer's argument that I'll kind of put it in different terms. The goalpost was moved because the last notice that he received before the actual hearing did not include three of the policies for which he was actually disciplined. So would it have been reasonable for him and his attorneys to assume that those were no longer on the table for purposes of the hearing, and perhaps then they focused their preparations on the violations that were actually alleged in that last notice before the hearing?
Certainly. I, of course, don't agree with the petitioners on that point. I do not think, and the way Loudermill and Matthews, Gilbert versus Homar describe due process is important, and this goes to Justice Dalit's question during the opening argument. Due process is a flexible concept. It is not a concept that is rigidly applied in all cases in a vacuum.
But what's your best case for saying notice is a flexible concept in this instance?
Well, my best case is Loudermill itself. And I've looked through the case law, and I've not found a case where any court actually builds up the distinction that opposing counsel wants this court to find.
What's your best case for it being a flexible sort of concept?
A flexible concept? I think you'd need to look no further than this court's Arneson decision. For Justice Kurofsky's benefit, that cite is 225 West 2nd 371. In that case, this court, quote, states, Loudermill does not clearly establish the process due an employee discipline short of termination. It also recognizes I apologize, I lost my place. But regardless, the Arneson Court does recognize that due process itself is flexible. Matthews recognizes due process is flexible. Loudermill talks about due process being flexible.
Due process, I understand what you're saying. But you're saying Arneson and Matthews support your proposition that notice is a flexible requirement.
Yes. I think that the point that was made before that the notice is part of the process is a key one. I don't think you can divorce notice from the process. You can't divorce notice from the Loudermill hearing itself. It's all part of the process. When Loudermill is talking about due process, procedural due process being a flexible concern, that necessarily encompasses both notice and the hearing itself.
Counsel, I need help with this then. Are you suggesting that whether or not there is notice, that the notice requirement is flexible, or the nature of the notice is flexible?
That's a good question. I think in light of Arneson, I think in light of Arneson and Loudermill itself, I think the answer to the question is both of those are flexible. Certainly, the Gilbert versus Homar decision calls into question where in non-termination cases, whether or not notice and opportunity to be heard is required at all prior to discipline, where there's post-discipline, reasonably prompt post-discipline opportunity for review. So
those cases were notice cases, the ones that you say support your flexible requirement. They're notice cases where notice was the issue.
Well, I resist the temptation to compartmentalize between notice and hearing. You can call them notice cases because they talked about the notice side of it.
Right. Regardless, I mean, like sometimes we get cases where it might be decided differently if counsel would have argued something differently, but they didn't. So we assume that that part was okay, and then we go on to the hearing and whether or not that was proper. My point is, what's the best case that talks about notice without sort of saying, yeah, this is what happened here, without really analyzing it?
I think the most clear case that I saw in reviewing for today was a case cited by this court in Arneson, the Seventh Circuit cases of Cheney versus Suburban Bus Division. That case clearly applied Matthew's flexible approach to due process to whether notice given to the employee in the case was sufficient. At 628, the Cheney court states, applying Matthews in these subsequent cases to the facts at hand, we have little trouble concluding that due process did not mandate giving Cheney additional notice or a hearing before Pace suspended him. Cheney's interest in avoiding a suspension is significant. Nonetheless, Cheney was on notice as to why he was being suspended, and Pace's interest in both managerial efficiency and in public safety clearly outweigh Cheney's interest in a pre-suspension hearing. The Constitution does not mandate additional protections at that stage. The way I read that Cheney case is saying that, especially in light of the fact that it was not a termination case, that the relatively minor notice that Cheney received in that case was sufficient, and that further notice beyond that was not required. I think that the notice given to Officer Weiss and to Mr. Weiss in this case far surpassed what was available to Cheney. Here, he went through three separate investigative interviews. At each one, he was handed copies of the policies which he was suspected of violating. Those policies were highlighted with the relevant language so that Mr. Weiss could have no trouble discerning what he was there for. He was represented by his union representative at all of those interviews. He was asked questions by the investigating detectives at all of those interviews and was given a chance to respond and speak up for himself.
So counsel on the other side is making a separation between that type of investigation and this quote-unquote Loudermill hearing, which actually reading all these cases may or may not apply, but so what do you make of that? How do you fit in this investigative stage versus this Loudermill hearing?
I don't think due process allows for the type of formalistic distinction that counsel is attempting to make. Throughout this case, at every level, the petitioners have come up with a new argument, but they've all boiled down to a very strict reading of due process such that the only proper notice could be something that was given after the investigation concluded, but before the Loudermill hearing. They are also saying that that notice has to be something formal. In their reply brief before this court, they focus on the word charges in Loudermill, as if the Loudermill notice now has to rise to the level of precision required of a criminal indictment. There's nothing in the due process case law that suggests that Loudermill notice needs to be anywhere close to that. And certainly the due process flexibility required by the United States Supreme Court throughout its due process jurisprudence does not require such an exacting level. I think that the due process analysis requires the courts to look at the entirety of the conversation regarding the discipline that leads up to the discipline. Certainly the entirety of the conversation leading up to Weiss's discipline here demonstrates that there was no way he couldn't have known exactly why he was up for discipline.
Counsel, I want to ask about one of the fascinating things about this case, and particularly with the amici we received as well, is exactly what law applies and how it applies. Is there's not unanimous agreement on that, right? Whether Loudermill even applies to this type of situation or not, for example. And obviously you've got the sort of unique angle here of an arbitration award. So my question to you is, what would you hope that an opinion from this court would say? There's maybe some danger in us saying too much in a case like this, particularly in light of the procedural posture. But if we would agree with you on some or multiple points, what would you wish us to say?
I think the court needs to finish the discussion it began in Arneson. It needs to look at the precedents and confirm that applying due process can't be done in a vacuum. And it can't be done rigidly. It needs to be in light of the facts and circumstances in each individual case. Petitioner's position suggests the opposite, that due process, at least with regard to the notice required under Loudermill, is not a flexible concept. I think that if the court goes down the road of implying or instituting new rules with regard to what notice counts and what doesn't, or whether notice is required short of termination, dividing line here, I think that opens the court up to numerous, this case is going to land before the court 10 times in the next 5 years, because the moment you begin setting forth specific rules in the due process realm, that's the moment that it introduces more complexity into due process jurisprudence that simply is not supposed to be there. Due process flexibility is there in order to preserve the discretion of the persons on the front line who have to take this court's decisions and make practical decisions based on that. If the court were to institute some rigid notice requirement here, the people on those front lines, people who aren't lawyers, who aren't prosecutors, who may very well be single-person shops, the chief in a rural village who is the only person there and who wears the hat of a human resources director, all of those people are going to be forced to try to pigeonhole their notice such that these rules are met. Any rule the court might announce would be met. I think that's dangerous, and I think it leads to potentially the possibility of far more litigation, because it allows for defendants or for employees to play gotcha. And gotcha is not what due process is all about. Due process looks to the substance of whether that person knew what he was up for discipline for and whether they had a chance prior to that discipline to speak up for themselves. The facts in this case demonstrate that Weiss had that notice and that he had the chance to speak up for himself on multiple occasions. If Loudermill applies, it is met here. If Loudermill doesn't apply, then I think going back to the Matthews balancing tests, the balance falls strongly in favor of the government here. It cannot be diminish the fact that Weiss lost an $80 per month stipend. He was not suspended, he was not demoted, and he certainly was not terminated. While, of course, he has a property interest in that $80 per month stipend, relatively speaking, it is somewhat slight compared to the government's interest here. Now, the government's interest wasn't, as opposing counsel suggested, the interest in only putting four policies or five policies on the Loudermill notice versus all the policies. The government interest we are talking about here is the government's interest in being able to effectively discipline its employees. And the effective discipline of employees is especially paramount for police departments, where the department has to ensure that its officers meet a certain level of conduct such that the protection of the public can be effectuated, which is the police department's primary goal. If police officers are able to evade discipline even when they share sensitive information about sexual abuse at a local high school, during an investigation that that officer was not even a part of, if he's allowed to evade that, what does that communicate to the public? What does that do to the department's ability to protect the public? And it's not just police officers. Nearly every public employer in the state of Wisconsin has an interest in protecting the public. School districts protect the students that are their charges. Fire departments protect
people. I may agree with you on all those things. Having said that, what's troubling me is whether notice under 164.02 is different from Loudermill. Is notice under 164.02 and notice, hey, we're going to expect you to come forward and we want to interrogate you on these things, then we'll figure out what, if anything, leads to charges? Or are they the same?
I don't think they're different, or I don't think they have to be different.
Okay, what's your best case for them not being different? Because at least the Milwaukee Police Association brief seems to indicate that in practice and otherwise, they're very different creatures.
Well, I don't think they're different in the sense, Justice Ziegler, that they are both part and parcel of providing due process to the officer.
Due process for an interrogation and due process for discipline. At least that's what I'm hearing. We can interrogate you. We expect you to come forward. We actually expect you to tell the truth. And then we're going to decide what, if anything, we're going to charge you with or discipline you for. Aren't they two separate things, or they are both the exact same creature?
I appreciate the distinction. And it is a hypothetical that I don't believe accurately describes this case. That being said, I think that 164.02 notice can be part of the notice provided to an employee subject to discipline. Now, and the reason why I don't think it applies foursquare to the facts of this case is because I don't.
That's a Loudermill notice. That's what you're saying? Under the way it just works, that's the same? Interrogation and discipline?
I think it's more nuanced than that. I don't think that they're identical. However, I don't think that you can replace Loudermill notice with 164.02 notice and call it a day. Okay. However, I think they're both focused on the provision of notice, which is a due process concern. And the reason I say that it's not foursquare with the facts of this case is because I think the record demonstrates quite forcefully that Weiss was provided far more than the requisite notice under 164.
You're not asking us to address that, though, are you?
No, I don't think it's a 164.02 case at all. I'm simply responding to the new argument that petitioners have raised in this court regarding the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights.
Can you just touch on the what I asked your friend on the other side about how this case is actually teed up for us and that it's teed up from an arbitrator's decision?
Absolutely.
And that aspect.
And I was at the first question that the court had for me today, I was 20 seconds away from getting to the standard of review.
We're kind of like that.
But the standard of review is the first thing in my outline because it is important and it governs this court's deliberations here. And I think it bears a little bit of quoting here. I think the Court of Appeals got it right. They began their discussion with the standard of review, and then they finished their discussion after having gone through the facts and the law and talked about how the standard of review simply did not allow them to overturn the circuit court below. This is a review of an arbitration decision, the scope of which this court's prior decisions established is extremely limited. That's the Scherer case, 64 Wiss Second at 726. Arbitration awards are presumptively valid, and overturning those awards requires a showing of clear and convincing evidence. Great deference is paid to the arbitrator's award, and mistakes of judgment or mistakes of facts or law are not grounds for setting aside an award, which is something that Justice Hagedorn referred to in his questioning of petitioners. Arbitration awards may only be overturned under very limited circumstances, and I think you, Justice Kurofsky, went through a few of those in the opening arguments. The only one that petitioners focus on here is manifest disregard for the law. I do not think... And that leads us to focus, right, on the arbitrator's decision itself. The arbitrator cites Loudermill and, albeit in a truncated fashion, analyzes Loudermill. One of the key points in Loudermill here is the availability of post-deprivation review of a disciplinary decision. The arbitrator talks about that in his decision. To me, the arbitrator does, in fact, discuss the law and correctly apply the law. But even if he didn't correctly apply the law, the standard of review says that mistakes of judgments or mistakes of facts or law are not grounds for setting aside an award. The arbitrator looked at the correct law and applied it.
So is it your argument that we do not independently review the constitutional due process arguments that are being advanced by the petitioner?
No, not at all, Justice Bradley, but I think that that review needs to be focused through the lens of the standard of review.
Could you expound on that a little bit? Because obviously we have to give great deference to the arbitrator's award, and they're not overturned except in very extreme circumstances, a broad statement, but I'll summarize it that way. So... are we applying that deference to the due process considerations that were made by the arbitrator? Even if the arbitrator might have gotten it wrong?
I think that's a very good question, and I hadn't focused on that one specifically, but I understand what you're asking. I think that the answer to that question falls within the purview of the discussion about what constitutes a manifest disregard of the law. I think when you look at how that phrase has been talked about, it looks not at whether or not the arbitrator got the law right. It looks at whether the arbitrator was in the right ballpark, to put it in terms like that.
So then you would have us look only through the lens of the standard of review that is highly deferential to the arbitrator's decision?
I think this court is required to do so, yes.
Okay.
How does WISSTAT 788.10 fit in with this argument?
Excuse me?
How does Wisconsin Statute 788.10 fit within this argument?
Well, I think... I'm not sure that beyond being the statute, just the chapter setting forth, you know, how arbitration occurs, it can provide all that much to the due process discussion itself, except for the fact that it's under Chapter 788 that we get the discussion from prior courts regarding what the standard of review of arbitral decisions are. If that answers your question.
This says that there must be an order vacating an award, and then there are criteria under which we would have to vacate the award. And I guess what I was looking at from you is, does a manifest disregard for the law fit within one of those statutory provisions, or is this something that stands outside the statute? How does it fit together?
And I believe you're referring to Section 788.10.
Yes, yes, I am. If you haven't had a chance to think about it that way, it's
yeah,
fine.
Well,
you know.
No, certainly the manifest disregard of the law is not language that's within that statute specifically. Case law certainly imposes that as one of the factors that may allow for overturning an arbitrator's decision. Certainly sub 2 of that statute stating that an award, or excuse me, sub 1D of that statute where the arbitrator exceeds their power or so imperfectly executed them that a mutual final and definite award upon the subject matter submitted was not made. I think that that probably speaks to the manifest disregard. But yes, that is much more of a case law generated standard as opposed to the statutory.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Fisher, in response to questions about whether or not the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the law, what I heard your friend on the other side say is, look, if you look at the arbitrator's decision, which I'm looking at right now, the arbitrator talks about the balancing between the Green Bay Police Department's goals and the content being discussed and what Officer Weiss's actions were. But what is not discussed here is the issue of the notice. And so I understood the answer to be that showed that the arbitrator did not exercise his discretion correctly, because even in the decision, he doesn't talk about the notice when he's talking about Loudermill. He's just talking about this other part of due process about the balancing.
Sure. That's a good question. Right. The arbitrator does not use the word notice. The notice question was briefed to the arbitrator prior to making his decision. That is in the record. The party's briefs prior to the arbitration decision.
Right. But I'm hearing the other side say this is how the arbitrator did not correctly exercise his discretion. So.
Well, again, the standard of review isn't erroneous exercise of discretion. It's manifest disregard.
And I'm hearing him say, right. That it was right. A disregard of the law because he didn't talk about the notice in his arbitration decision.
I understand the point you're making. However, and as I began saying, the parties did brief it. And this court's prior decisions make it clear that the appellate an appellate court operating under a great deference standard, if there's a reason to uphold the decision, even if the decision doesn't say anything at all about the correct law, then the decision should be upheld. The Court of Appeals actually provided a citation specifically in that regard. Stating an award may not be attacked on the grounds that a portion of it could conceivably be allocable to an allegedly improper item. That's the Scherer case again. The Court of Appeals also stated, and I see my light is red.
You may finish your sentence.
Okay. The Court of Appeals also stated that, citing the Lukowski case, accordingly, an arbitrator cannot be said to have manifestly disregarded the law if substantial authority sustains the arbitrator's assumptions as to the law.
Can I ask just which paragraph that is, Chief Justice?
Paragraph?
Which paragraph? I just want to know what paragraph you're reading from.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's paragraph 25 of the Court of Appeals decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chief.
Yep.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
I think there were a few questions as to really does Loudermill apply. It does. On page 546 of the Loudermill decision, so it's 470 U.S. at 536, the court said, quote, the tenured public employee is entitled to oral or written notice of the charges against him and an explanation of the employer's evidence and an opportunity to present his side of the story. Now, why do I bring that up? Twofold. Number one, Loudermill does apply. Number two, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, I believe, asked counsel whether or not this was an issue as to the nature of the notice or whether it being flexible or notice being flexible. I would posit that flexibility it comes in terms of the nature of the notice. Notice could be given orally. It could be given in writing. I've been representing police officers for over 27 years, and I can tell you 99% of the time it's given in writing simply because there's a record as to what was the notice that was given. Nobody has any question about it. I think an important case to look at is the Birdsell case, B-I-R-D-S-E-L-L, versus Board of Fire and Police Commissioners of Litchfield, and that's a Seventh Circuit case, 854 F-2nd 204. It very clearly said, so it's a Fire and Police Commission case, it's Seventh Circuit, and it's talking about notice or a failure of notice being given to a police officer. It says Matthew's balancing test applies to the notice as well as the hearing. Quote, notice must be reasonably calculated to apprise interested parties of the pendency of the action so that they can adequately prepare.
Counsel, I want to ask a question. The I understand your position is that, you know, some of these federal cases and the due process standards were not complied with, but suppose I disagree with you, and there's at least a really good argument that they were, okay? And obviously the Court of Appeals thought they were, even if there's an argument the other way as well. But there's at least a good argument that sufficient notice was given. Can you win under the standard of review if you take that to be true? That there's at least a reasonably good argument that enough notice was given.
Would I acknowledge that there's a reasonable?
No. I'm assuming that there's at least good arguments on the other side that this was complied with, as, for example, the Court of Appeals held. That's not a crazy argument. It's a legally sound argument on the other side of you. And you may disagree with that, but assuming that's true, can you win under the standard of review for vacating an arbitration award?
Yes, I can. And here's why. Chapter 788 says that a court must overturn an arbitrator's award when the arbitrator exceeded his or her powers. The Racine County case then goes on to explain that, quote, an arbitrator exceeds his or her powers when the arbitrator demonstrates either perverse misconstruction or positive misconduct, which I don't allege here, or two, when the arbitrator manifestly disregards the law, and three, when the award is illegal or the award violates strong public policy. So that's how 788 applies. Now let's get to your question, Justice Hagedorn. The standard is whether or not the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the law by failing to address the notice issues and whether the government had a legitimate interest in not providing notice ahead of time in that Loudermill notice that it took pains to draft and serve, whether the government had a legitimate interest in not telling Officer Weiss everything, not showing Officer Weiss, this is what we got, this is what we're looking at, what say you? They didn't do that, okay? That under Matthews versus Eldridge is one of the factors that should be looked at. You know, they look at the three things. What's the interest involved? Whether or not the risk of erroneous deprivation, and most importantly, the government's interest. So what interest did the government have in failing to provide that notice? None. This wasn't a situation where they were up against the gun. This wasn't a situation where Officer Weiss was charged and in custody. They chose to give him notice of five rules. They chose not to give him notice of all of them. And I notice that my light is red. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, the court is adjourned, and we in closed conference, depending on our next obligation, approximately 30.